The air was already a hot, humid haze by the time the sun began its ascent above the trees surrounding Mobile Bay. Daylight struggled to penetrate the density of the July air. It certainly failed to cut through the thick pall of smoke lazily curling upward from the wreck. Until very recently, the ship had been a large schooner, two-masted and nearly 90 feet long, far bigger than most of the scows hauling fish around the Gulf and the vessels making regular runs to Havana for sugar or to Mexico hauling crates of whiskey. Now the massive schooner was almost completely burned away. The hull was barely visible, charred to the waterline. That had been the intention. The Clotilda was evidence of a rash of crimes, each one carrying serious punishments. Evading customs, falsifying documents, smuggling, and, most egregiously, breaking the now 50-year-old ban on the importation of enslaved people. In theory, violating this particular law was punishable by death. In practice, not one person had ever suffered such a penalty. Even so, the Clotilda's owners weren't taking any chances, which was why Captain William Foster had stacked 7 cords of highly flammable wood in the hold and set it alight. The ship had been valuable, it was only 5 years old, but not as valuable as avoiding the attention of the authorities. The ship that Foster was so keen to destroy had, until recently, held 103 Yoruba people captive. On top of their intermittent imprisonment in the hold during the weeks-long Atlantic crossing, the captives had been trapped inside the Clotilda's stifling underbelly for days to avoid detection by anti-slavery patrols inspecting suspicious vessels entering Mobile Bay. Throughout the ordeal, Zuma and Abashe, Konko and Shamba, Osia and Kosula, Yawith and Omolabi, Gumpa and Bougier, and nearly 100 more had suffered, sang, sweltered, retched, cried, and survived. 7 people had not. The white sailors had thrown their bodies overboard for the sharks. One captive, a 2-year-old girl, not only survived her capture and the Middle Passage, but would live another 80 years after this particular July morning in 1860. When Matilda McCreer died in 1940, she was the last known survivor of the transatlantic slave trade that had, over the course of nearly 400 years, brought more than 12 million African people to the Americas. Welcome to Past Lives. I'm Patrick Wyman. Between the 16th century and the 1870s, more than 12 million people were trafficked from Africa to the New World. Nearly 2 million of those souls died on the Middle Passage, killed by disease, starvation, and the vicious punishments meted out by white slave ship crews. Rather than continue to suffer these agonies, many captives chose to take their own lives, refusing food or throwing themselves overboard, preferring the omnipresent sharks to whatever fate awaited them in the Americas. The transatlantic slave trade was both one of the greatest crimes in human history and one of the foundational systems of our modern world. Simply put, there is no making sense of the 21st century without first contending with the fact and legacy of the transatlantic slave trade in the Middle Passage. While this colossal forced migration lasted for centuries, it didn't last forever. The nascent abolitionist movement that grew out of the efforts of Olaude Equiano and his contemporaries in the 1780s soon bore fruit. The British, the most prolific traffickers of the 18th century, abolished their slave trade in 1807, while the United States followed suit the following year. France and Spain banned the trade in 1818. 2 years later, the U.S. added teeth to its ban to the importation of captive Africans by declaring the practice to be an act of piracy and punishable as such. Brazil and Portugal, the last holdouts, legally prohibited the practice in the 1830s. To prove that these actions weren't empty political gestures designed to assuage the consciences of those who had most profited from human trafficking, the Royal Navy dispatched warships to patrol the coast of West Africa, regularly intercepting vessels that were attempting to continue the slave trade illicitly. As heartening and effective as these efforts were, they were nowhere near enough to stem the flow of enslaved people being illegally trafficked across the Atlantic, even to destinations that had formally outlawed the trade in human beings. The last captive Africans were transported to Cuba in the 1870s, more than 50 years after Spain was supposed to have abolished the practice, while the final shipment arrived in the United States on the eve of the Civil War. The last survivors of this horrific migration were still living in the early decades of the 20th century. When a blossoming generation of scholars and journalists sought out these elders, the last living witnesses to a centuries-long trauma, they were met with countless memories and a keen understanding of the need to document them. In today's episode, we'll focus on the last survivor of the last ship to smuggle captive Africans into the United States, the Clotilda, which arrived in Mobile Bay in July of 1860. Its passengers were the last known survivors of the transatlantic slave trade. The last of them, Matilda McCreer, who was an infant when the Clotilda carried her from her home across the Middle Passage, died a free woman in Alabama in 1940. For those 80 years, the scorched hull of the ship that first imprisoned her lay just below sea level in Mobile Bay, a remnant of a past that cannot and should not stay buried or be forgotten. Before we dive in, I want to talk a little bit about sources, because that's an interesting story in and of itself. The survivors of the Clotilda first came to prominence in the 1920s, thanks to the work of Zora Neale Hurston, whose novels and short stories about African-American culture and experience made her one of the most celebrated and impactful figures of the Harlem Renaissance. Hurston, a trained anthropologist, spent months interviewing a man known as Cudjoe Lewis, or Kosula, who had arrived on the Clotilda. The resulting interviews became the masterpiece Barracoon, a book that would not see publication until 2018. That same year, 2018, archaeologists discovered the wreck of the Clotilda precisely where it had been burned and left to rot away back in 1860. In the years since Barracoon's publication and the ship's discovery, further work has dramatically expanded what we know about the vessel, its owners and operators, and its human cargo. The jointly authored volume Clotilda, The History and Archaeology of the Last Slave Ship, sums up that work. For this episode, I'm also relying on the historian Hannah Durkin's incredible book, The Survivors of the Clotilda, The Lost Stories of the Last Captives of the American Slave Trade. Matilda McCreer was the last known survivor of the Clotilda's final journey, but that fact didn't become apparent until 2020, when Hannah Durkin's work brought her life to light. Before that, a woman named Radoshi, who was interviewed and even filmed before her death in 1937, was thought to be the last. McCreer was the youngest passenger to endure the journey. She was only about 2 years old when the Clotilda left West Africa, and a little over 80 years old when she died. Unlike Kosula and Radoshi, McCreer had far fewer memories of the land of her birth or the Middle Passage, which meant she had less to share with the journalists and anthropologists like Zora Neale Hurston, who emerged in the 1920s, seeking the ancestral stories of a past that was rapidly slipping away. McCreer was taken at such a young age that slavery deprived her even of the knowledge that would have left an identifiable trail for later researchers to easily find. The story of the Clotilda's survivors began just before dawn one April morning in 1860, in a town called Tarkar, located in what is today southwest Nigeria. The farmers who, in the cool pre-dawn, had left through Tarkar's eight gates to work the fields of corn, melons, and nuts were already dead, killed silently by their attackers before they could raise the alarm. Most of the remaining townsfolk were asleep in their homes. Shouting and gunfire startled them awake. Some, like 15-year-old Abashe, immediately jumped out of bed and tried to make a run for the safety of the forest. Radoshi, aged 12, also tried to run, but she was quickly caught. "I fought," Radoshi said later, "but they beat me. I don't know what they were saying, but it wasn't good." Women warriors with shaved heads chopped at Tarkar's gates with axes and machetes and fired flintlock muskets at anyone who appeared to be resisting capture. A second line of male warriors caught anyone else trying to escape. Radoshi couldn't understand her captors because they were from the neighboring Kingdom of Dahomey, an aggressive, expansionist realm of warriors and slave raiders, best known for its famous corps of women warriors. The reasons for Dahomey's rise and increasing antagonism were straightforward. The long-lived Oyo Empire of western Nigeria and eastern Benin had disintegrated in the opening decades of the 19th century, clearing the way for Dahomey to use its well-equipped standing army to terrorize neighboring Yoruba communities like Tarkar. Slave raiding was far more profitable for the kings of Dahomey than selling palm oil to European merchants. It also provided them with the firearms that made the kingdom a powerful military force, and the trade goods that made its kings and nobles wealthy. European demand for enslaved people continued unabated even after the slave trade was made illegal, and Dahomey's leaders consciously exploited that demand to advance their own political agenda in West Africa. As with Maul and the Indian slave trade we discussed a few weeks ago, it was a combination of indigenous agency and priorities, combined with the demand for enslaved bodies in the Americas, that powered the slave trade. The people of Tarkar were unlucky to live so close to Dahomey. They were well aware of the danger. Military training was standard for the young men of the town, like Kosula, who spent his later teenage years learning to use the spear and bow. Faced with a much larger attacking force and no warning, however, Tarkar never stood a chance. The gates fell quickly to the experienced Dahomey warriors, who had plenty of practice efficiently sacking settlements like Tarkar. Kosula remembered that the women were too strong to fight, even though he was a strong young man himself. Hundreds of Tarkar's residents were captured. The rest were killed, shot with muskets, or cut down with thick-bladed swords. Tarkar's ruler was dragged before the king of Dahomey and beheaded after refusing to become a prisoner. Many others were likewise decapitated, and the soldiers took the heads with them as trophies, along with their living captives. The raid was over by dawn. As the burning sun rose in the sky, the captives were chained around the neck with irons and placed in a long line to be forcibly marched for long hours through the forest. Six children accompanied one woman, then around the age of 30, who would later be renamed Gracie by her Alabama master. The youngest of these six children was just 2 years old, and it was this toddler who would come to be known as Matilda McCreer, the last survivor of the transatlantic slave trade. The column made camp that night. The next day, the decapitated heads of Tarkar's slain inhabitants began to rot in the sun and heat. On that second night, the Dahomey warriors stuck the heads on poles and smoked them above the fire, an event Kosula was able to recall in detail more than six decades later. After 2 weeks of marching through the coastal slave ports, including Lagos, the future capital of Nigeria, the captives arrived at Ouidah, located in present-day Benin. Millions upon millions of newly enslaved people had passed through Ouidah on their way to the New World over the past two centuries. Kosula, Radoshi, and Matilda McCreer were among the very last. After several weeks imprisoned in Ouidah's holding pens, or barracoons, the captives from Tarkar were loaded onto the ship that would carry them across the Atlantic to Mobile Bay, the Clotilda. Compared to many of the vessels that had made the crossing over the past 200 years, the Clotilda was relatively small. A two-masted schooner weighing some 120 tons and measuring 86 feet long and 23 feet wide, with a 6-foot-deep hull. Constructed in 1855 by enslaved laborers at a shipyard north of Mobile, the Clotilda's was an unusually large, deep hull for a schooner putatively intended for use in the Gulf of Mexico. In its first years of service, the Clotilda officially carried sugar, salt, animal hides, cotton, meat, whiskey, and lumber on its many voyages between Mobile, New Orleans, Texas, Mexico, and Cuba. But the ship's unusually large hold offers some clues as to its truer, darker purposes. Even in its voyages around the Gulf, the Clotilda could well have been involved in trafficking enslaved people from Cuba, where enforcement of the slave trading ban was intermittent at best. In January 1857, the Clotilda arrived in New Orleans, its cargo unspecified. The local firm with which it was dealing had links to the slave trade. The very next year, 1858, members of that firm would be named as unindicted co-conspirators in a scheme to transport 300 captives from Africa to Cuba. Smuggling human beings in defiance of the 1808 U.S. ban on the slave trade was common practice. Demand for enslaved labor was rising, not falling, as the United States teetered closer to civil war. The profits could be immense. Captives purchased for $100 in West Africa could be sold for $600 in Cuba or $1,000 in New Orleans or Mobile. Proponents of reopening the slave trade, and there were many, not just in the American South, were perfectly aware of that math. It was the hunt for those outstanding profits that drew together a diverse consortium of investors for the Clotilda's proposed voyage to West Africa. Nova Scotia-born shipwrights, doctors and lawyers, some of Alabama's richest planters, and a trio of Maine-born brothers, the Mears, who had relocated to the Mobile area to exploit the demand for lumber and ships. James Mear, the eldest, ran the brothers' steamboat and lumber businesses. The younger two, Thomas and Burns, captained steamboats. Burns Mear stood a towering 6'3" and had recently received a vicious knife wound running from his elbow to his shoulder, leaving a distinctive scar. The knife had been wielded by Burns' own steamboat clerk, just to give you a sense of the kind of people we're talking about here. The Mear brothers took the lead in planning the voyage, gathering individual $1,000 investments from some of Alabama's most prolific enslavers. These men had already shown an interest in flouting the ban, having supported the pro-slavery adventurer William Walker's attempt to conquer Nicaragua and turn it into a slave state in 1855. There was a growing movement in the South to reopen the slave trade, supported by both economic incentives and the strains of the pro-slavery movement that would eventually lead to secession. The Mears meant to capitalize on it. The Mears, along with the Clotilda's builder and Captain William Foster, prepared carefully for their scheme. They reinforced the ship's masts and spars to hold a greater weight of canvas, allowing for greater speeds on the open Atlantic. After loading the hold with provisions, they placed layers of fresh-cut timber on top to conceal far more food and water than they could possibly need to reach their claimed destination, the Caribbean island of St. Thomas. Upon arrival in West Africa, the crew would use the lumber to build platforms for the captives in the hold. Foster came on board on the morning of March 4th, secreting in the captain's cabin a bag of gold that he would eventually use to purchase the enslaved captives. Aside from Foster, the Clotilda's 11-man crew had no idea they were going to Africa. That wasn't clear until the vessel arrived at Cape Verde Islands off the African coast in mid-April of 1860. The sailors were, predictably, incensed since the voyage was far longer than they'd anticipated, as well as much more dangerous, not least because what they were doing was completely illegal. Foster was forced to offer them double wages to calm them down, which the sailors accepted. Money always talked in the slave trade. While the Clotilda was evading Portuguese anti-slavery patrols on its way to Ouida, the captives from Tarkar sweltered and suffered in the horrendous barracoons, circular slave pens with thatched roofs, high bamboo walls, and little ventilation. Matilda McCreer, Kusula, Radoshi, and the others in their group spent 2 weeks packed into the barracoons before Foster and the Clotilda arrived. Unlike the prisoners, Foster was received in style by the King of Dahomey. Following 8 days of negotiations, the captain agreed to exchange $9,000 in gold, plus cloth and alcohol, for 125 captives. Foster inspected each one carefully, taking only the strongest and healthiest, as they had the best chance of surviving the Middle Passage and would prove the most valuable to Alabama buyers. The captain preferred children and teenagers, like 19-year-old Kusula, who remembered how invasive the inspection was. Foster had examined his face, stuck his hands in his mouth, and, though Kusula didn't mention it, had looked at his genitals as well. It's impossible to imagine the horror of this scene, which had played out millions of times at Ouida over the past 2 centuries. 2-year-old Matilda McCreer was too young to understand what was happening, but her mother, Gracie, wasn't. Foster selected Matilda, her 3 older sisters, and Gracie for purchase, but not Matilda's 2 older brothers. She and Gracie would never see the boys again. Another young woman, Bougier, was separated from all 3 of her children, one of whom was still an infant. A young man named Yawith was ripped away from his 2 children. That night, the Dahomeyan guards provided a large feast for the 125 captives before their departure, which only intensified their sense of impending doom. They didn't know where exactly they were going, but it was clear that they would never see their families again. The chains came out again the next morning, binding groups of 8 men and boys before they were fastened with padlocks. The women and girls were roped together. Gracie carried Matilda, who was too young to walk by herself, as they crossed a wide stretch of marsh with water so deep that it nearly drowned the shorter captives. Then came the beach and their first sight of the Clotilda, anchored a mile or so out to sea, just a smudge on the horizon. The canoes that rowed them out to the Clotilda managed to avoid capsizing in the heavy surf, but the boatmen did strip the people of Tarkar of their clothes, leaving them effectively naked on board ship. There was, however, a problem. Once 75 of the 125 captives had been loaded, the sailors on board the Clotilda spotted 2 steamboats bearing down on them. The ship, and its highly illegal cargo, had been spotted by an anti-slavery patrol. Only 110 captives were brought on board before the Clotilda hightailed it. Matilda, tragically, was among them. Kusula was on the very last canoe to leave shore. It was May 24, 1860, and for the next 13 days, young Matilda and her fellow captives would be locked inside the hold. No respite, no breaks on deck, just unbearable and never-ending heat, thirst, and the filth of 110 people forced into close proximity with one another in a confined space. The Clotilda wasn't as crowded as some slave ships. 79 of the 487 captives on board the last ship to arrive in the United States 2 years earlier had died of suffocation and disease, but it was still pure hell. Kusula remembered the thirst. Radoshi, then 12 years old, remembered preferring death to life. Matilda McCreer didn't remember the crossing at all, but her mother, Gracie, told her that it was evil-smelling. On the 12th day, the Clotilda passed the final headland on the African coast before the open ocean, Cape Palmas in present-day Liberia. But a sighting of yet another anti-slavery patrol made Foster wary of letting the captives out on deck until they were at sea. Finally, they were brought up out of the hold, so weak and drained that they could barely stand. Bougier, who had been separated from her children in Ouida, later remembered, quote, "She can't see nothing, just endless water." For the next 32 days sailing across the Atlantic, the captives were allowed on deck more frequently, but Foster scanned the horizon endlessly with his spyglass, keeping an eye out for more patrols. Anytime he spotted another sail, the captives were forced back into the hold. Any sense of time disappeared. Quasula thought the voyage took 70 days, not 44. Radoshi thought it might have taken a year. The horrors continued as they traveled. At least 7 captives died at sea, including a young boy, Matilda McCreer's first cousin. Each one was unceremoniously dumped overboard and taken by sharks. On the 37th day, the Clotilda passed the Bahamas. The danger of anti-slavery patrols rose dramatically, but Foster had a solution. He removed the additional sails and yards that had allowed the ship to cross the Atlantic so easily, making the vessel look like any other Gulf schooner. On July 7th, their journey was nearly at an end. They had at last reached the waters off Mobile Bay. For Foster and the crew, trouble was afoot. The lookout who was supposed to have spotted the ship coming into the bay wasn't there, and the sailors threatened to kill Foster if he didn't pay them what he owed. Foster was able to calm the crew and left the Clotilda to rally his co-conspirators for this final stage of the voyage. The Meyer brothers arranged for a steamboat to pull the Clotilda up Mobile Bay, with the captives forced to spend all day lying in the sweltering hold, with temperatures reaching over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Under the cover of darkness, the ship and its tug navigated the narrow waters of the Spanish River to avoid the customs post on the Mobile River. Foster and his crew eventually heard the 11 o'clock bell ring out in Mobile, and they stopped for good at 12 Mile Island, well above the port proper. There, the captives were forced onto a waiting steamboat called the Czar, and once again locked in the hold for a day-long journey up the Mobile River to a plantation owned by one of the conspirators, a man named John Dabney. Once the captives were offloaded, the Clotilda was set aflame and scuttled to destroy the evidence of their crime. The sailors who had crewed the Clotilda left the Czar for another waiting steamboat, the Roger B. Taney, fittingly named after the infamous Supreme Court justice who authored the Dred Scott decision 3 years earlier. The double wages Foster had promised his outlaw crew never materialized. Instead, he threatened them with a pair of pistols and told them to, quote, hit the grit and never be seen in southern waters again. They were on the mail train from Montgomery to New York the next day. The Clotilda's arrival was known almost immediately, of course. A schooner doesn't anchor itself in Mobile Bay and spontaneously combust. The local customs officer informed the Secretary of the Treasury, who opened an investigation. As the investigation got underway, the conspirators shuttled the captives around in smaller groups to avoid detection by the authorities. The prisoners from Tarkar were in terrible condition, afflicted with parasites, various intestinal and skin conditions, and perhaps scurvy as well. Radoshi remembered eating grass before she was eventually given cornmeal and water. The captives were then taken to Burns Meyer's plantation, another 50 miles upriver. He was the Meyer brother who'd been gashed with a knife, where the survivors were finally sold. Day after day, the remaining captives were forced to stand in rows while potential buyers inspected them in degradingly invasive ways. Two by two, they were marched away from Burns Meyer's plantation to their new lives of enslavement. This was perhaps the most difficult moment of all for Quasula, Radoshi, Gracie, little Matilda McCreer, and the rest. Another forced separation. This time from the only people who could understand exactly what they'd been through together. A former Alabama state legislator named Washington McMurray Smith purchased Radoshi and another man whom she was forced to marry. One of the Meyer brothers kept Quasula. Families once again endured the incomparably agonizing horror of separation. Matilda McCreer, her mother Gracie, and her 10-year-old sister Sally were all purchased by one memorable Walker Cree, one of the largest enslavers in the county, but not Matilda's two older sisters. We in the 21st century know that the Civil War would soon formally end slavery for the survivors of the Clotilda and millions of others, but they couldn't know that. The next 5 years saw them all experiencing the everyday cruelty and degradation of enslaved life in the American South. Long days of brutal work, vicious overseers, severe punishments for escape attempts, and sexual assault aimed at producing future children for the auction block. The conspirators who facilitated the Clotilda's journey and enslaved the survivors were never held accountable for what they'd done. The Clotilda survivors lived on after the end of the Civil War brought emancipation to Alabama. A group tried to raise enough money to fund their return to Africa, but the amounts involved were simply too great. Instead, some purchased a plot of land from Timothy Meyer, one of the brothers who had enslaved them, and established a new community called Africatown. In 1914, when the artist and writer Emma Langdon Roach visited Quasula, there were 8 survivors of the Clotilda left. Roach reported that they still preferred to speak Yoruba among themselves, and Quasula had given his children both American and Yoruba names. those old enough to remember life before enslavement worked hard not to forget what had been taken from them. Despite the passage of so many years, it was still difficult for Kusula and Radoshi to discuss the circumstances of their capture and transportation. Some survivors refused to speak of it altogether. Matilda McCreer may have been too young to remember much of anything, but she bore the trauma of the events like everyone else. Still, the Clotilda survivors worked hard to make good lives for themselves. They created families, traditions, and a lasting legacy out of the worst possible circumstances ever brought upon human beings. When she died in 1940, McCreer was the last known survivor of the transatlantic slave trade. One perspective might see her death as the close of a particularly dark chapter in human history, and that's reasonable enough. When events pass out of living memory, a shift has absolutely occurred in time and space. But the legacy of the Middle Passage and the slave trade are still with us each and every day. The Clotilda's prisoners were the last of millions who, together, quite literally made and remade the United States. What was done to them, not what happened, was done by people who knew full well what they were doing, was a monstrous crime at the time, and it remains a grisly stain on the soul of this country today. It will for as long as we as a country choose to ignore or deny it. Those who minimize the many impacts of slavery, whether they're politicians or talking heads on cable news or content creators on social media, ought to be forced to read accounts like those of the Clotilda survivors, people like Kusula, Radoshi, and Matilda McCreer, until their eyes bleed. It's the least any of us can do now in the present. To bear witness to the crime that was chattel slavery in America, to understand how it shaped the world in which we live now, and to try to work against the myriad effects that have trickled down through the years. We, all of us, live daily in the shadow of history. It cannot be ignored or denied, in no small part because people like Matilda and Kusula and Radoshi pass their memories of it down to us. That's why history matters. This marks the end of our first season's scripted episodes. I have learned so much while researching and writing these, and I appreciate you all joining me on the journey. In our final episode of this season, dropping next week, I'll be talking about what stuck with me from our journey through 2,500 years of slavery. Thanks so much for joining me, and I look forward to chatting with you again. If you haven't already, please subscribe to our Patreon, linked in the description. It's only $7 a month, and you get access to tons of bonus content, like interviews with great scholars, Q&As with me, our book club, and much more. You can follow me on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick or on Blue Sky at Patrick Wyman. Past Lives is a 100% independent production, and your support is what allows us to make this show. So, thank you. Past Lives is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The producer is Morgan Jaffe. The music and sound design is by Gabriel Gould. The story editor is Rachel Cambori. Until next time, this has been Past Lives.